Greetings and good evening, everyone, and welcome back to the Mark Fraley Podcast. Today is August 31st, 2017, a gray and overcast, drizzly day here in Nashville. We're just now getting the remnants of Hurricane Harvey, which has ravaged Houston, Texas. It is coming on fall, and the days are getting shorter, and the temperatures are cooler. You know, we learn in elementary school that trees are part of the fabric of life. Trees, of course, filter the air and water of carbon and produce the oxygen that is necessary for life. Trees also provide food for wildlife and for us. Indeed, our economy depends on trees to provide fruit, building products, paper, and other materials. I think it is safe to say, however, that the common citizen rarely gives the management of trees a second thought. However, as our society continues to move into cities, the management of trees and the urban environment will be of critical importance to our health and to the health of the environment which surrounds us. Last week, I had the pleasure of traveling to Ellington Agricultural Center and to interview Brian Rucker. Brian works for the Tennessee Division of Forestry and manages the Tennessee Urban Forestry Program. It was great fun to get to know him a little bit and to learn about what he and his colleagues are up to. I hope you will enjoy listening as we discuss the problems which are occurring in urban forests and the quite successful efforts that they are making to keep these forests healthy for all of us. Well, Brian Rucker, welcome to the Mark Fraley Podcast.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Thank you for taking some time out and speaking with us. We're out here at the Ellington Agricultural Center in South Nashville. A beautiful campus. I hadn't been out here in a good while, and it's a beautiful day to be around out here.
Yes, wonderful. Just after the eclipse?
That's right. Yesterday was the eclipse. And we're at the offices of the Tennessee Division of Forestry today, meeting with Brian Rucker, who is head of urban forestry for the state of Tennessee. Brian, would you tell our audience a little bit about yourself and your background?
Okay, well, I'm born and raised here in Nashville, Tennessee, and I was always involved in scouts as a child, and I think that really shaped who I am today.
Okay, cool.
Always being out in the woods and learning how important trees are to the environment. And I was very fortunate enough to go to the University of Tennessee, where I studied forestry, wildlife, and fisheries management with a concentration in forest management. Upon graduation with a bachelor's degree in forestry, I worked for before and after school care for a while, dealing with children anywhere from going into kindergarten to going into the sixth grade. And that was an amazing experience. And I think from that, coming into forestry, I started out with the state in the FIA program, which is Forest Inventory and Analysis, doing plots across the state.
Okay.
And there was an opportunity in urban forestry after having doing FIA for 5 years, and I came into urban forestry, and I've been here ever since.
Cool. And when did you start in urban forestry?
Started in urban forestry around 2005.
So I knew Bruce Webster had been the urban forester for many, many years. Did you succeed him, or how did that?
There's kind of like some gray area in there, but okay. Yeah, Bruce Webster was the coordinator of the program.
Okay.
And I think by the federal definition, I am the coordinator of the urban program here for Tennessee.
Okay.
But my official title is the Urban Forestry Program Specialist.
Okay.
Is my title.
Tell us what that involves. You have people in West Tennessee, East Tennessee. How does that work out?
Well, in urban forestry, we have two other positions. One is in West Tennessee, and that is Sean Posey. He's our regional urban forester, West Tennessee regional urban forester. And then in East Tennessee, we have Tom Simpson, who is our East Tennessee regional urban forester. And we've hired a new person, Diane Warwick. and she heads up our riparian program.
Oh boy, that's interesting. That's a new wrinkle.
Yes.
So, all right. So, you know, we have growing cities here in Tennessee.
We do.
And I know that there's a lot of concern about trees in our urban environment. Can you give us an overall status of trees in the urban environment in Tennessee? Is this a concern? How are we?
I would say overall, Tennessee's trees in urban environments are in really good shape.
Okay.
We have put a lot of effort into meeting with our city foresters, meeting with tree boards, meeting with city officials, some nonprofit organizations, and really getting the word out on the importance of trees. And I think a lot of communities, such as Nashville, are really making a lot of efforts on valuing trees, valuing the resource, and trying to improve that resource.
Right. Now, the urban forestry program has several facets, as I've looked at it. There is a thing called Tree City USA. Is that something that you're
yes.
all involved in?
Yes. Through the Arbor Day program, the Arbor Day Foundation, we administer three programs that they conduct, and one is Tree City USA, one is Treeline USA, and Tree Campus USA, which is fairly new. It's compared to the others, Tree Campus has only been around for about 6 years, but Tree City is that flagship program with the Arbor Day Foundation.
And how many towns and cities in Tennessee are enrolled in that at this point, or can you say?
Currently across the state, we have 45 Tree City USA communities. And so to become a Tree City USA, you have four standards.
Okay.
And the first standard is that you must have a tree board or an advisory group. The next standard would be that you have a tree ordinance that really regulates the tree selection, maintenance, and removal of trees in the community on public property. And then you must spend at least $2 per capita on a tree program. And then the fourth standard is finally that you celebrate Arbor Day with a proclamation.
Okay. Well, those are pretty easy standards, it sounds to me. Most of those are kind of administrative things that the city council can do pretty easily, except for the money part of it, of course.
I would say that really establishing an ordinance and the financial obligation are the two toughest to do. And
okay.
those are the ones that most communities struggle with.
Okay.
But then with our expertise, we've assisted numerous communities, even those that aren't Tree City, we're still there to assist
right.
them. And so we have assisted many communities through our office on developing, improving ordinances, municipal tree ordinances, and then also going in and almost doing somewhat of an audit and trying to see, well, where is money being spent?
Right.
And trying to figure out whether or not they do spend that $2 per capita.
They may be doing it and they don't even know it.
Yes, nine times out of 10, for the most part, they're doing it and they don't even realize
right,
it.
Right.
Yes.
Now, I know some of our cities have their own forestry staff. I just off the top of my head, Gene Hyde in Chattanooga was a friend of mine for many years. I don't know whether he's still working with the city of Chattanooga, but is that what you're seeing with the major cities?
Yes, we are very fortunate that all of our major cities currently do have city foresters. Nashville does, Chattanooga does, and we just gave the city of Memphis a grant to support a city forester there. So through our grant system, our federal grant system, we are currently supporting three city foresters, one in Cookeville, one in Crossville, and one in Memphis on a 3-year sliding scale so that the city realizes the need and what a city forester can do for a community. And so through our grants program, that's a position that we have supported over the years, and it kind of went away and we brought it back, and the interest is pretty high.
So what do you hope to accomplish with that?
With establishing a city forester?
Yes. What's the program generally? I mean, what are the outcomes that you're looking for out in the future?
Really, it's better management of Tennessee's urban trees is what we're getting out of it. So everything that we're promoting, whether it's information and education, whether it's outreach, whether it's ordinance development, and whether it's establishing a city forester, is really geared toward better management of our trees in our communities.
What do you see are the problems that are being encountered in management of city trees?
I think one of the big issues that we are trying to tackle now is urban wood waste. On the forest health side, we have quite a few pests that have invaded Tennessee's, not only the rural forest, but also the urban forest. And so through...
For example,
you have the emerald ash borer that has come over from overseas. It's gotten established, and it has worked its way down from the north, and it has found... really from East Tennessee through Middle Tennessee, and it's working its way west. And one of its major modes of transportation was through logging, through logs being passed, and also firewood that gets moved in and out of natural areas, park areas, where people bring that in and they burn it and then take it with them and take it somewhere else.
Bringing the bugs with them.
Yes, right. Yes.
And is there also an issue with, you said tree waste, so I presume it's more than just logs. People hire a landscaping crew to come in and take a tree down, an arborist. They have a grinder or a chipper.
A chipper, yes.
And that debris, who knows where it goes.
Yes, and that's one of the things we have now is that wood is now starting to get regulated on where it can and cannot go. So if we're within a quarantined area, and really the quarantine now really falls along I-65 south, and from north of Nashville down south of Nashville is really kind of where the line, there's a little gray area in there, but those counties along that line is really kind of where the line falls for quarantined area. So within a quarantined area, you can move ash logs, green ash, white ash, blue ash, you can move those logs wherever you want. There's no restrictions. But you cannot take that wood out of a quarantine area into an unquarantined area unless it's been treated. And that includes just firewood as well as running logs on trucks.
Okay. So that's an interesting, and also would include chip debris, that sort of
yes.
thing?
Okay. Yes, it would need to be treated before it gets taken gotcha. Out of a quarantined
gotcha.
Area. Yes.
Gotcha. So what are the other problems that we're encountering in our urban forest?
Another issue we've had is gypsy moth. And that's another one that's come over from overseas. And, you know, they start out in the ports and then they establish themselves and then they just continue to spread across a given area. And so that's another one that's kind of come in and it's moving east to west.
I've seen that in Pennsylvania and it
yes.
defoliates the deciduous forest.
Yes.
I mean, and it does it cause permanent harm to the forest?
Well, there are times that most trees can take a defoliation probably once in their growing season. But once you get two or three, you know, a few years back we had a bad frost that was in the spring. And so that had knocked out those leaves, ruined those cells. And so those leaves had died off and then another set of leaves had sprung out further on into the summer. So trees can usually sustain that. But if you have that over multiple years and then you have dry conditions like we have and trees are already in a stressed environment, then when you start defoliating the food that the trees are producing and they can't produce that food for the roots for storage, then that's usually when the trees start to suffer and they end up dying.
So where in Tennessee are we having trouble with the gypsy moth?
Gypsy moth, it's like I said, it's yet again, we have another bug that's kind of moving east to west. It's been here longer than the emerald ash borer. I believe it's just on the other side of Interstate 65 going west. So I think that it's been found in Dixon, as far west as Dixon, and maybe even beyond that. But the trapping that we've done for those, for that insect has really been good. And so the pheromone they use to attract the male, because the male is the one that flies, the pheromone they use to trap that has been really good at reducing that population. And usually the trapping has been so well to the point that in following years, it hasn't been found in areas where it was found the year before.
Okay, well, I didn't know about that.
Yeah.
Where would we find those traps? Where are those out put out?
We put those traps out on a grid using GPS coordinates. Okay. And so you may or may not see a trap just out in everyday life, because they try to put on opposite sides of the road, so in passing you would not see them. But if you see a triangular orange or green trap, then that's fairly small in size. That's the gypsy moth trap.
Okay.
Yeah. And then there's only certain times that they put them out, because there's during that little breeding season that they have running through the spring. That's when the traps are out, and then they're collected, and then they're counted and looked over to see were there any moths caught.
Now, is this something that the local urban foresters are involved with, or is this something that is done at the state level?
This is done at the state level, and this is done because it's multi-state, so it turns into more of a federal issue. So there is federal money that gets set aside towards forest health, and it comes down that deals with the gypsy moth trapping, that deals with EAB trapping, and any other insects that are defoliating and hurting our forest. So especially insects that are invasive, that have come in from other countries.
Well, you've hit on a term, invasive, and you've talked about two invasive organisms. But we also have invasive trees.
Yes.
Are you all involved in that fight?
We are involved. That is mainly through our forest health unit. Is that when you look at trees like ailanthus, that is a tree of heaven,
yeah.
But it's like some people say it's a naturalized invasive, because it's kind of gotten here and just kind of taken hold, and it's all over the place. And the Prince's tree, Royal Polonia, is an invasive tree. But it has a market overseas that people used to grow it here almost in groves and ship the wood overseas. And it was really, it had some really valuable wood. But another is, and whether you call it a tree or bush, but honeysuckle is an invasive. It can be listed as a tree. Some people list it as a tree and some call it a bush. I lean more towards a bush than a tree. But it is definitely an invasive that was brought over here to be planted in harsh conditions. And as we've seen, especially in our urban areas, it is all over the place. And it is very difficult to get rid of.
Right.
Yes.
Right. Now, is this something that your local tree ordinances speak to, or not?
Not
types of trees that people should be.
There are some. We kind of shy away sometimes of telling people to put specific trees in their ordinance to say this is what we'll plant, this is what we won't plant, because there are so many different species out there. And when you're in an urban environment, a lot of times you lose your soil profile because the soil has been turned over so much during construction. So there's a wider variety of trees that you can plant. So to pigeonhole yourself and say that we will only plant these. But people have put in there that you will not plant invasive exotics. So even like mimosa, an invasive that was widely planted, now it's one of those that has been taken off the list. Well, it's been put on the invasive list. And so at a lot of nurseries, you can't even buy that anymore.
Right.
So.
The speaking to the the cities, what specific, or are there any specific species that you all observe or people are having better luck with as street trees?
Well, there are the popular ones, which when you look at, there are so many different types of red maple, and people love planting the red, whether it's Red Rocket, October Glory. They just keep genetically altering the trees to whatever conditions they want to fit it into. Zelkova seems to be a very widely planted street tree, as well as lacebark elm or Chinese elm. That is another one. Little leaf linden, we've seen that quite a few times as a street tree. There's a variety out there, and there's a lot of different choices, but we let each community find what's best for them. And sometimes they ask us for our assistance, and we come in and we can give suggestions. But it's their choice to make, and if they have a city forester, if they have someone that they consult, an arborist on retainer, then usually they're making some pretty good choices. Okay. So where we come in is to ask them to make sure that the trees are properly planted and also properly pruned and maintained.
Now there's an interesting issue that we see in our at least in Nashville. An emphasis of trimming trees around power lines and making sure that that's done properly. Are you all involved in that?
We are very fortunate to have a former utility forester on staff, Tom Simpson, our East Tennessee Regional Urban Forester, and he has spearheaded the effort on bringing utilities in on our Tree Line USA program. We lead the nation in tree lines. And that is trying.
What does that mean, you lead the nation in tree lines?
We have more Tree Line USA utilities than any other state in the country.
Okay, so you have better cooperation with the industry then.
We have through Tom, we have had that in.
I got you.
To walk into a board meeting, to walk into one of their conferences and get up in front of them and say, this is one of your own and this is the reason why you should follow this program. And so we've been very fortunate that other companies, other utilities that are in the program have also worked with us to try and bring in other utilities into the program.
And so what are the outcomes there?
The outcome, one of my former boss's statements, Bruce Webster, was that the utility company has probably the greatest impact on the urban forest than any other group, because they are there every single day pruning trees along power lines. And so with that understanding, we knew that we needed to go to them and talk to them and say, for a better overall health of your trees, especially in areas, especially like with co-op utilities, they cut in so many different communities, and it's communities that we do not have an in, and we try very hard to get an in with everyone and try and establish that relationship. But there are some communities that just do not, at the time that we speak with them, they just do not have the effort of trying to maintain or develop an urban program. So by having that utility company already on the program, then we're still making some headway for those citizens.
So looking at the activities of those utilities, what are the practices that you're trying to encourage or discourage?
Well, one of the major things that we talk about is, and we know that so much utility is now going underground. So we tell people, you tunnel, you don't trench. Because more times than often, when you're digging your line, you're not trying to go around, snake around in and out of every tree. You're digging a straight line. So much of that trenching was coming right next to tree trunks, and they were cutting off anywhere from 35 to 45% of that root system of that tree.
Okay.
But when you tunnel, then you're just burrowing underneath those roots. And so you're tunneling through, and you're not disturbing that root system as much with the trenching. So another thing that comes along with that is using spikes to climb trees, because so many arborists go up in trees to trim. If you don't always, use your bucket truck. So instead of putting those spikes on and creating those wounds as you're climbing up that tree, then we get away from that practice and you use more of your ropes and put your ropes up in there and you pull up that way, other than than using spikes and creating those wounds. So another thing that they have to do in the program is that they have to have a certified arborist on duty. And whether that is the manager who manages the workers or you have your individual workers as certified arborists. And then another practice that was commonly done and is still done today is when they want their 15 feet of clearance, then they would cut and just leave a branch stub. And that's not a good practice for trees.
Okay, I'm glad to hear you say that, because I was going to ask you, you have some ugly, ugly situations that are left sometimes.
Yes. When you have those branch stubs and you cut it off and you leave 2 or 3 feet of branch still attached to the tree, then that tree cannot heal that over.
Better to have cut the limb off altogether.
It's better to have cut the limb at the branch collar, which is the correct place to cut, and then the tree can go from there, and then it can heal over that wound, or it can cut that limb off where it was cut and not allow insects and disease to come into the trunk of the tree.
And then, of course, topping trees.
We definitely do not top. So, yes, that is another practice and that's what tree line does. You have to change your policy, you know. And the policy is that you do not top trees, because that's all you're doing is leaving branch stubs is when you're rounding over. So you have all of these instances where you're inviting disease and insects into a tree by rounding over. And even like with most maples, you can tell even on some old growth trees where they were topped in the past, because maples kind of have that spider effect when you cut that branch off, and you'll see 8 or 9 branches around that cut. And so I call that the spider leg effect, because that's what it looks like as it's getting bigger. So you have these branches getting larger all around where you've just created this huge wound on this tree. So you have weakening wood with growing branches, and that just causes problems for later on in life.
Yeah, all of those spiders that are left are all weak.
All that epicormic branching, though, that branch is not established in the heartwood. Epicormic branching.
Okay, well, that's not one I've heard before.
Yeah. All trees, even though the branches are established, you can tell when you have those little limbs that pop out on the sides, that's not attached to the heartwood. That actually starts that year on the outside of the bark. So you have a lot of buds that are just dormant, that when you make cuts on a tree or when you invite light in to the bowl, to the trunk, sometimes it can trigger those buds to start growing. And then you have those small branches on mature trees or even small trees, that's where that connection starts, right out there on the outside of that tree.
So
that's
weak.
It's a very weak joint.
Yeah, yes. So if we get ice or whatever, they're going to fall.
More than likely, then they will be broken off. Wind and ice storms, yes. Right. Yes.
Let's talk a little bit more about some specific species that are, let's say, desirable or undesirable. And coming to mind as a tree that gets a lot of talk is the Bradford pear. You knew I was going to ask about
I knew we were pear. Going down when you started saying species.
The Bradford pear seems to be becoming a problem.
Bradford pear is a problem, and I will say that we've made a lot of headway on really canceling out that tree.
Tell me what you mean.
When you have a tree, one thing that you don't want is you don't want sharp angles between the branch and the trunk of the tree that it grows out of. And so as you can see with Bradford pear, you have basically all of their limbs come out of one spot. So you have a gigantic weak area of a bunch of limbs that are all coming out at the same place. And then on top of that, you have what you call included bark. So when you have a sharp angle, which is 30 degrees or less between a branch and the trunk of the tree or another branch, they in turn grow into each other. And they do not grow into each other and fuse together. What they do is they grow together and then start pushing each other apart. So it makes that joint even weaker. And then when you deal with the wind blowing the branches and you have that constant rubbing back and forth, then that just creates more problems, invites more disease, invites more insects, and it continues to make a weak joint of wood, which is why when you have windstorms and you have snowstorms, you see a lot of Bradford pears that fail. And it's usually 40 to 50% of the tree, if not the whole tree, that fails. You don't see one or two branches. You see a large chunk of the tree that breaks off.
So then we have the fact that the Bradford pear is a cloned tree. Each tree is related to all the other trees.
Yes.
So theoretically, they're
all the same.
All the same and not able to reproduce.
Bradford pears are supposed to be sterile, right. And there are situations where they revert back and they produce a seed and the seed will grow. We have seen that before.
So they're
supposed
all
to be sterile.
The calorie pear, which came
they're
from
China.
They're
all in the pear family, right. Yes.
And so you do have situations now where we actually have we have pear trees. I don't know whether you'd call them Bradford pears, but they're pear trees that are coming up wild.
Yes.
Is this a problem? They're not native pears.
It can be a problem in areas. I know when I was in FIA, there was a place up in Hermitage that was an old field. It was a reverted home, and it was had Bradford pears everywhere. But most cases like that, it's going to be mowed. They're going to be maintained areas. It's not. You don't have areas where Bradford pears are that are reverting back to woods, so you have Bradford pears all over the place. 9 times out of 10, that area is going to be disturbed again, either by mowing or cutting or something that's going to take those out.
Okay. You do. I see them coming up in the along roadways, and they're an early bloomer, so they're easy to identify.
Yes.
So this is something you're discouraging people to use.
We do have a do not plant list.
Okay.
And whether it's like the ash that has EAB or whether it's the walnut tree that had the walnut twig borer that was recently hitting, or it's just the Bradford pear that, or like a silver maple that has weak wood, poor branch angles, and it's very susceptible to insect and disease, then we do have trees out there that we will not pay for, and we will suggest that other people not purchase them to plant in their communities.
We have seen some of our local groups here in Nashville plant. We're going to plant 100,000 trees in the particular time or whatever. I know that the Tennessee Environmental Council's got a program going on right now for tree planting.
Yes.
Are you all working with them on that?
We are working with the Tennessee Environmental Council. We have supported their, what started out as a 50K tree day, has gone to a 100K tree day, which is now going to be 250,000 trees planted in one day across the state. Yes.
And how are you all involved in that?
They apply for a grant from us, from the state, to assist with the purchase of the trees. Okay. And so we have assisted them each year with purchasing the trees. And the Division of Forestry itself is also involved in the logistics. And most of those trees purchased come from our nursery.
I was going to ask.
So we have been taking trees from our nursery, and we take them to the drop-off points where people then come pick them up to be planted.
Okay. So you all have nurseries.
We have one nursery.
Well,
we used to have two.
Hiawassee and Pinson.
Pinson. We still own the property of Pinson, okay. But it is not technically a working nursery.
I got you.
The only nursery we have now is down in Delano, which is down by the on the Hiwassee River. Yes.
Right. I remember when that property was acquired.
Yes. We've had it quite some time.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Beautiful area, too.
It is lovely down there, absolutely. Now, you, when we first got started talking, you mentioned a riparian program.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
One of the newest programs that we have started is our riparian tree program. And what we've seen is that we needed to be at the forefront of protecting stream banks and protecting water. Clean water is important to everyone. And so one of the ways that we were out there trying to achieve that is through our riparian tree planting program. And we have it for rural and we have it for urban. We use our Tennessee Agriculture Enhancement Program money, our TAPE money, which is state funds. Part of that is dedicated to planting trees in riparian areas, which can be is a 35-foot buffer on each side of a stream bank where you want to have trees and grasses and other things, not just a mowed area, to kind of buffer and filter water as it's coming into a stream. And it also protects a stream bank and helps combat erosion.
And flooding too, probably.
Flooding as well, yes, yeah. Yes, yes.
Can you tell us about an installation or an example of one of those installations?
We have, our program first started from a grant from the feds, and there were 9 watersheds defined here in Davidson County. And so we had a grant program to go out and start reclaiming stream banks. So we had multiple partners, whether it was, I believe it's Harpeth River Alliance, Cumberland River Compact, Nashville Tree Foundation, and I think there's a White's Creek watershed where trees were planted up there. And so along almost all waterways flowing in and out of Davidson County, we were able to have some trees planted along those. On the Glen Levin property, sure. We had trees planted there, right down the road here on Franklin Road, and then also going back the other way south at the Edmondson Pike Library. Behind that is the 7 Mile Creek, and we planted there. There was also some church property here close by where we planted trees as well. And a lot of times, especially in urban areas, people are so used to and they want to see nicely mowed, well-maintained areas. And they don't realize that that is what leads to a lot of erosion. And that's okay. What puts a lot of impurities that goes into right. the streams without being properly filtered. Right. So there has been a little bit of pushback, but we have signs and outreach, and a lot of that was done with volunteers, that program on the tree plantings. So there's a lot of people out there that were assisting us in fighting that cause of protecting stream banks.
And as they assist, they learn.
Yes.
I guess that's
yes.
the point.
That is the main thing, yeah. Is the learning and the teaching.
Right.
Yes.
And that way,
yes.
they bought into it, not it being not a manicured
yes.
place all the time.
Yes. Okay. They did have to understand that there's more than just mowing the grass and keeping it nice and well manicured.
Right.
That the importance of trees and protecting that water, protecting those streams, and also protecting their drinking water.
There's been an emphasis here in Nashville and to some extent across the state, well, certainly across the state, in greenway development as part of city park systems. That sounds like a natural connection between the riparian program that you're describing.
Yes.
So you have a lot of city park people doing that sort of thing?
At the moment, with our riparian program, we have not, but we're building that. One of the ways that we've been getting on greenways has been through our Arboretum program.
Okay, tell us about that.
So with our Arboretum program, we wanted to come up with a way of having somewhat of an outdoor classroom or a learning location within each community where citizens can go and walk and enjoy nature and also learn while they do that. So through our Tennessee Urban Forestry Council, which is a statewide nonprofit group that actually works through us, and we work through them to kind of get a lot of our needs met, we established the State Arboretum Program, which has five levels, and a level one is simply 30 trees, 30 different species labeled with scientific name and common name. So as you go up levels, you need more trees, or you need, and you would also need an interpretive map, and some of it, as you increase levels, like level four, level five, you need to have a dedicated person that's on duty to assist people that come by, and then to the point where you have guided tours with increased levels. So our Arboretum program is something that has really taken off, and through that Arboretum program, we've established centers of excellence, which is where if somebody wanted to learn more and maybe hold meetings, whether it be a tree board meeting or a neighborhood meeting or something like that, that we could have those. So we have three centers of excellences across the state. One is in Memphis, at the Botanic Garden in Memphis. There's one here in Nashville that's at Cheekwood. It's a center of excellence. And then in Knoxville, well, up in Oak Ridge, we have at the UT Woodlot, there is a center of excellence there. And so those are places that you can go and you can learn, and they offer programs, they offer training, all different kinds of things on the benefits of trees.
We have other arboretums here in Nashville, I presume.
We have an established arboretum that's down in Brentwood. We have an established arboretum that's in White House. The grounds here at Ellington Ag Center are labeled. And just this year, we've been very fortunate to have the governor's mansion is now a state arboretum. So we went in and we mapped out their grounds, and we have all the trees labeled, and they have a tree trail over at the governor's mansion. And so we had a dedication ceremony and all that, and it was a wonderful time spent with the governor's wife, Miss Haslam, and also the...
Is it Vanderbilt campus?
Vanderbilt campus is not. I do not believe.
Because I know that they have done a lot of tree labeling over there mm-hmm. over the years.
I would need to go back, and it is a program that's run by our council. We do assist them with it. Okay. So, but if you go to tufc.com, then you can see their arboretum list, the statewide list, from west, east, and middle.
And this is the Tennessee Urban Forestry Council.
Yes.
Right. And do they have full-time staff, or is that just a volunteer?
They have two part-timers, okay. One an executive director, and then they also have a webmaster.
Okay. Very good. So, Brian, are there any other things that you would like for our listeners to know about what you're up to?
Well, I would definitely say that anyone that needs assistance or anyone that has questions pertaining to trees, that they would definitely give me a call. I'm always available, and we provide a free service. And my phone number to contact me is 615-837-5439. And so we have a lot of information that pertains to tree selection, tree maintenance, proper tree planting, proper tree pruning, establishing a tree board. We also have an activity book that's available for, it's really geared towards fourth grade students. We had one year, the city of Franklin use that activity book in their curriculum in school.
Okay.
So we do have that activity book available. So if people have meetings or seminars or workshops that they put on, then we have a wealth of information that could be passed out at those events. And then we also have our, every year we have our Tennessee Urban Forestry Conference. This year it's going to be in the city of Knoxville, and it's coming up next month. I'm not quite sure the specific date, but we're very excited because that's bringing together a lot of like-minded people that are all geared towards exploring new ideas and new ways of managing trees.
And a member of the public could attend that?
Maybe? Yes, that is...
You have to register and do the
You do have to register, and there is a fee, but you can pay a one-day fee. You can pay for the full conference, however you want to do it.
That sounds like something that would be enjoyable.
Yes, yes. It's always a good time with those guys.
Brian, you know, you mentioned at the outset that you were involved in scouting as a child.
Yes.
And gives me goosebumps because that's a big deal to me.
Yes, yes. It was a big part of my life growing up.
You learned early about trees and the environment.
Yes.
You learned, you know, an oak tree from a maple tree, from the different kinds of trees.
Yes, okay. Yes, yes.
And I find it interesting that many of my friends who call themselves environmentalists, and clearly they are concerned about the environment, don't know their trees.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about that?
All I can say is I wish I could put forth the effort to learn. We need people. We need all that we can get to help us with the fight.
Right.
On making trees important to city officials,
right,
and letting them know why we need trees and how urbanization is here. Our cities are getting larger, they're getting more connected, and we're losing more of our urban resource every day. And this is why we need to change the tide, and we need to, if not increase our tree resource, maintain it. And we need those people to help us fight. And I will tell you, and a lot of our tree boards now, because like with Nashville, when you have so many people immigrating daily, you have a lot of people coming in that grew up in cities, grew up in an apartment, never had a yard, never, they may have gone out and enjoyed the woods a time or two, but they really don't know, but they know they want to be involved. And so that is really starting to comprise the makeup of a lot of our tree boards, is that people just want to be involved and they're thirsty for knowledge. And so that's why we're there, to kind of help quench that thirst any way we can. And then we all meet at the conference so we can all further our knowledge together.
Okay. That's fascinating that you're saying that some of these folks who are self-identified as an environmentalist, someone who's concerned about it.
Yes.
They're learning.
Yes, yes, they're learning, definitely learning. And they have a passion, you know. And there are some people that have gone out and they've, you know, it's difficult to stay up to date on everything.
Right.
So sometimes we have to rely on those people because they're out there and they're reading what's new and what's happening now and what new ideas are coming down the pipe. And so they inform us, and then that kind of leads us to, okay, well then I need to start putting some effort into whether it's doing some kind of a canopy cover, whether it's some new management practice, whether it's a new way of identifying hazard trees, or whatever the situation is. You know, there's that exchange of ideas, and you have to be open to it, because if you shut them out, then, you know, there's consequences to that.
Exactly.
So
they'll never be available again.
Yes, exactly. You can lose that interaction and that rapport, and you can have your base lose faith in you, right, if you're not receptive.
Right. Well, Brian, it's been a delight to speak with you. We've gone for 45 minutes here, and the time has passed very quickly.
Very fast. Yes.
And I hope
to encourage my listeners to, if they have questions about trees in their urban environment, to give you a ring or to give one of the local urban foresters a ring.
Yes, definitely.
Thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you. I appreciate it.